All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our final lecture of the series, The World That Was, Rabbinic Martyrs of the Holocaust. This evening, Be'ezras Hashem, we will be discussing the life and story of Rabbi Simcha Zelig-Rieger. If I could subtitle this lecture, as you will soon find out, the subtitle of this lecture would be Majesty and Tragedy. And we will see much of both in this evening's presentation. I want to give a big yishar koach and a big thank you to Rabbi Kasorla, my friend and colleague, for lending me the book that we'll see in a moment has been very instrumental in putting together this evening's lecture. If you take a look on page number 2, there are really two sources that we have of information on Rabbi Simcha Zelig-Rieger's life. The first is a book by Rav Shimon Yosef Mela, originally in Hebrew, on the Brisker Rav. The Brisker Rav, who was the rabbi in Brisk after Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and we'll discuss both of these personalities at least somewhat briefly this evening, has a whole chapter on Rav Simcha Zelig, and we'll discuss that as well. That is, if you will, the more yeshivish version of Rav Simcha Zelig's life story. The version that tells you the story of Rav Simcha Zelig as a Rav and as a Poisek and as a Dayan and as a Talmud Chacham. All of that is in Rabbi Mela's book on the Brisker Rav. But then there is another book, and that is written by Sarah Riga, who is a professor at CUNY in New York. She is the granddaughter of Rabbi Simcha Zelig-Rieger. Her father, Moshe Avram, wrote a memoir which contains a tremendous amount of information about his father. And Professor Riga also interviewed her father about her grandfather, and that is contained within this book, which Rabbi Kasorla so graciously lent me. The rest of the information from this evening is coming from scattered sources that we will be discussing. As we will soon discover, there is there's a lack of organized information about the life of Rabbi Simcha Zelig-Rieger, which is part of the tragedy, the tragedy of his life and subsequent martyrdom. Very briefly, you'll see at the bottom of page number 2, this is the pretty much the only biographical information available on Wikipedia in English. There's a little bit more in Hebrew, but it's always good to know what's out there on Wikipedia. Rabbi Simcha Zelig-Rieger, born, we're not entirely sure, somewhere between 1863 and 1864. We do know that he died in 1942 on Dalet Mar Cheshvan, along with the vast majority of the Jews of Brisk, in the Brisk ghetto. We do know when his birthday was. Anybody want to take a guess when his birthday was? Yesterday. Yesterday was Dayan Rieger's birthday. And while I was putting this source sheet together, I texted Rabbi Goldberg and Rabbi Moskowitz that there's a certain siyata dishmaya that happens when you're putting together a shir, and it turns out to be a significant date in the life. In fact, probably the most significant date in the life of Rav Simcha Zelig-Rieger. Wikipedia will tell you that he was the chief rabbinical judge of Brisk and surrounding Lithuania, and you will see the picture is a painting of a picture that was taken on the left-hand side. Anybody know who that is? The left-hand side of that picture is Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, and on the right-hand side of that picture is Reb Simcha Zelig. Of course, the front cover is probably the best picture that we have of Reb Simcha Zelig, and we'll talk about a little later why we don't really have any pictures of Reb Simcha Zelig. You'll see the map on page number 3 is the total distance, pretty much, that Reb Simcha Zelig traveled in his life. He was born in Nevardak. You'll see that in the middle. Nevardak, of course, which is a Musar, one of the giant cities of Musar, had a tremendous yeshiva. that had one very unique interpretation of the Musar tradition of Rabbi Shlomo Salanter. He grew up in Nevardak until more or less the age of 10. His father was a Malamed. His father was a big Talmud Chacham and a big Malamed. He was one of three brothers, and he was the only one that had the last name Riga. Why did he have the last name Riga? He did not live in Riga. Not only did he not live in Riga, he also lived nowhere near Riga, and neither did any member of his family. How did he have a last name Riga? Riga was an invented last name that his father invented for him at his birth. The reason for this was because he had two brothers. And this was the time of the chappas, that authorities would come and they would capture Jewish children and take them away to serve in the army. Once you served in the army, you were there for the next 25 years. That was the end of your life. They took rachmanis on families, rachmanis, that only had one son. Because he had two brothers, so they knew two of them were probably going to be chapped. So what his father did was, from the day they were born, the story was spread that these were not his biological children. They were cousins that came from other places that were living with them. And for that reason, from their birth, they had different last names. So that nobody of the authorities would suspect that they were brothers. Would instead have thought of them as cousins, which is why he, I suppose, got to live at home for the first 19 years of his life. And we'll talk about that in a few moments. But up until the age of 10, he lived in Nevardak. Growing up in Nevardak, he learned primarily with his father. He was known as an Ilui, as a brilliant child already from a very young age. From the age of 7 or 8, he was known to be well known in Bavli, Yerushalmi, Shas and Poskim. He was a child for the storybooks, but these kinds of stories, you know, sometimes they're exaggerated. From everything that we know about Reb Simcha Zelig, this was not exaggerated. He was a brilliant, brilliant child. Studious, diligent, big-time bookworm. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. He knew everything. He knew everything and loved to learn. At the age of 10, his father sent him and then moved along with him to Brisk. And he lived in Brisk from the age of 10 to the age of 19, at which point he moved to Volozhin. And we'll talk about those two transitions momentarily. What's worth knowing is about Brisk at the time is that the Rav of Brisk was a man by the name of Yehoshua Yehuda Leib Diskin, otherwise known as the Maharil Diskin. Maharil Diskin, if we haven't at BRS done an evening on the Maharil, we should at some point, right? We should do a whole evening on the Maharil Diskin. He was brilliant, brilliant beyond compare. Ad Kedekach, they tell stories about Maharil Diskin that he would read through the tshuvas and the svarim of other Talmidei Chachamim, of other big achronim, rishonim, and then people would ask him questions, and he would tell them according to which posek, how they would have answered the question. Not that they did answer the questions, but meaning he would say, you know, this is how this rav, this posek, would have answered the question that you're asking based on the style of his svarim and the way that he thought. He was one of those geniuses that got into the kishkas of the svarim that he wrote, the svarim that he read, and the psakim that he authored. He was the Rav of Brisk. You'll see this is, again, taken from Wikipedia. He served as the Rav of Lomza, eventually ending up in Brisk, and then moved to Eretz Yisrael somewhere between 1887 and 1888. And he opened the Diskin Orphan Home in 1881 in Eretz Yisrael. When he left Brisk, and this is going to be very important for our story, who took over as the Rav of Brisk? The Beis HaLevi. The Beis HaLevi, the original Yashub Be'er Soloveitchik. The Beis HaLevi is the great-grandfather of the Rav of Rav Soloveitchik. Zechad Tzadik V'Kodesh Livracha. His great-grandfather was the original Rav in Brisk of the Soloveitchik dynasty. As an 11, 12 bar mitzvah boy in Brisk, Reb Simcha Zelig was a shamish for the Maril Diskin. What that means that he was a shamish was he would sit in the Beis Medrash and learn, and people from the community would bring their chickens. This is how all the storybooks say it, that they would bring the chickens. That was the number one question that Balabasta had was, is the chicken kosher, is the chicken treif? Right? You're talking about a world that people would save up pennies, and they would get a chicken Erev Shabbos, and then they would go to the sheichet, and the sheichet would shech the chicken, and then would open up the chicken, and if it was poshut that the chicken was kosher, it was kosher. And if it was poshut that the chicken was treif, it was treif. But if there was ever a shaila, you had to go to the Rav. That was how it worked. You went to the Rav. You went to the Rav, and the Rav had to then paskin, is the chicken kosher, is the chicken treif? Now, by the way, if the Rav was a machmir, they did not eat chicken very often for Shabbos. And the Rav was a mekel, so then they had chicken more often. I understood this when I started learning Yeridei in Smicha in Yeshiva University, that the topic that touches the pulse of the Jewish community, of Jewish history, throughout the ages is Yeridei. It's the questions of Issa v'Heter, that which is permissible, that which is forbidden. These were the questions that ultimately touched the pulse of Jewish life throughout the ages. Because in every community there were balabastas, and in every community there were chickens, and in every community there were rabbanim that had to rule about these chickens. And when you read these shailas and tshuvas, you see what life was, that people were living these questions. This was Shabbos to Shabbos. This is how they lived. This is what the world was like for them. So women would bring the chickens to the Maril Diskin before Yantip, before Shabbos, and he would be sitting in the Beis Medrash, and then he would either nod his head or shake his head, nod his head if it was kosher, shake his head if it was treif, and young Simcha Zelig at this point would then go back to relay what the Maril Diskin had paskined about the chicken. So already from a very young age, he was getting what we call Shimush Talmid HaChachamim. He was taking very, very careful, cautious care to ensure that messages were relayed accurately, that sensitivities were being adhered to in the way that Psak Halacha was being transmitted. Ad Kedei Kach, so much so that Maril Diskin once said to him, even as a young boy, we're talking 11, 12, maybe bar mitzvah, he said, one day you too will be a posek for Klal Yisrael. Little did he know that not only would he be a posek for Klal Yisrael, a halachic decider for the Jewish people, but it would be the successor of the Maharil Diskin in Brisk. In Brisk, he would be the posek, not just for Brisk, but as we will see, for the entirety of the Jewish world in Lithuania and beyond.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Here in the United States, we also have Rav Shriskel.
Right.
Who also passing the same thing on chickens.
That's it.
And depending upon the economic status of the wife, of the woman, he would say, Hirataman, are you married? In other words, if she had a husband, he wasn't so lenient, but if she was a widow, he was...
You found every kula in the book.
He knew that she wouldn't have a chicken for Shabbos. I know.
Yeah.
So
we're gonna dive into quite literally the kishkas of some of these questions as they arose. Once the Maharil Diskin makes Aliyah, he goes to Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Simcha Zelig is living in Brisk up until the age of 19. At the age of 19, it's time for him to get married. And the Baal Tekea of the Volozhin Yeshiva is a man by the name of Rav Avram Rudensky. He's the guy that blows shofar. The Baal Musaf. His father was the Baal Tekea. This is the Baal Musaf, the guy that davens Musaf for the Yom Narayim in the Volozhin Yeshiva. This is no small matter to be the guy that davens Musaf in the Volozhin Yeshiva. He says, I'm looking for the best bacha, the best boy for my daughter, whose name was Sarka. And word gets around that Rav Simcha Zelig is the best guy, and they get married. Rav Simcha Zelig joins the Volozhin Kollel. He was known as one of the first Brodenskys. There was a Jew by the name of Yisrael Brodsky, who had a scholarship fund. That's what we'd call it today. It was a scholarship fund that for his mishpacha and later for himself after he was nifter, that Rav Simcha Zelig got 4 ruble a month. 4 ruble a month, which was apparently a sizable sum of money to be able to sit and learn. He was supported as part of this kolo by the scholarship provided by Yisrael Brodsky. So he was known as a Brodetsky for that reason. And apparently his children write that he would learn through Mishnayos. Le'ilu Nishmas, this Yisrael Brodsky, for the rest of his life. He observed the Yartzeit of Yisrael Brodsky because he had supported him when he was in Volozhin Yeshiva. He gets to the Volozhin Yeshiva. At this point in time, the Rav in Brisk is Rabbi Yosef Ben Soloveitchik. And these two events are quite important. Because while Rabbi Yosef Ben is the Rav in Brisk, his son, the great Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, is a Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin. At one point in time, when Rabbi Simcha Zelig arrives in Volozhin, Rabbi Yosef Ben Soloveitchik arrives, he's meeting with his son, and he's faharing some of the boys. He wants to see what's going on in the yeshiva. So he sits down with Rabbi Simcha Zelig. He wants to know how what kind of Yid Rabbi Simcha Zelig is. His famous bacher, Rabbi Simcha Zelig. And Rabbi Chaim says to his father, he says, don't quiz him on what he knows. Just watch how he learns a Blat Gemara. You watch how he learns a Blat Gemara, you will see everything that you need to know about this Jew. And from that moment, there was established a very close friendship and a Rebbe-Talmud relationship between Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik and Rabbi Simcha Zelig, who was considerably younger than Rabbi Chaim, a few decades younger than Rabbi Chaim, as we'll discuss in a few moments. But Rabbi Simcha Zelig arrives in the Volozhin Yeshiva, which you'll see, this is the famous picture of the Volozhin Yeshiva on page number 4. He arrives in the Volozhin Yeshiva, and he becomes one of the very few students to become a Talmud, both of the Netziv of Volozhin, Rav Talmud Tziv Berlin, and Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim and the Netziv were in many ways fierce opponents as co-Rashi Yeshiva in the Volozhin Yeshiva. There's a certain shalom that exists in that their kvaris, their graves are right next to each other. They're buried right next to each other. But they were fierce opponents politically within the yeshiva, as well as in terms of their styles of learning. The Netziv's style of learning was exceedingly broad. He would sit down with a Blat Gemara and then talk about how this sugya applies to everything from the opinions of the Tanaim to the Amoraim to the Rishonim to the broad scope of the sugya as it expands throughout the Talmud. He required that his students have immense breadth and depth of knowledge in every single piece. And that was how he learned. Rav Chaim, on the flip side, took not a macrocosmic view of learning, but a microcosmic view of learning. For Rav Chaim, there were really only two things that he cared about. He cared about the Gemara and he cared about the Rambam. And every single letter of the Rambam was delved into with a microscope. And one can understand that certain students that valued broad swaths of knowledge being discussed at great lengths, loved and cherished the style of the Netziv. And one can imagine that those students that loved the intricate analysis, the intellectual acrobatics, would love and prefer the style of Rav Chaim Volozhin. Very few Talmidim in the yeshiva became strong students of both. Rav Simcha Zelig was one of the few and the proud. This lasted for a few years until the death of the Beis Halevi, until the death of the original Rabbi Yosef Ben Soloveitchik. And the position of Rav of Brisk was offered to Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim was ostensibly quite excited about the position, but insisted, he said, I will take the position of being the Rav of Brisk on one condition. And that is that my student, Rav Simcha Zelig, comes with to be the Dayan. You get a 2-for-1. Either you take both of us, or I'm not coming. Now, it's worth pointing out, and this Sarah Riga puts in her book, it's not super complimentary, but it's worth understanding for the sake of the personalities, is that Rav Simcha Zelig himself had applied for different positions in the rabbinate. In fact, he got very very far, apparently, for one particular probah. I don't remember immediately what city it was. But he went off proper, he interviewed, and they loved him. They said he was certainly the biggest Talmud Chacham that was interviewing for the position. They didn't offer him the job because he was not a great public speaker. He was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a London par excellence, and a Dayan that was unparalleled, but not an excellent public speaker. Reb Chaim, on the flip side, was, of course, an immense Talmud Chacham and a tremendous Posek, but was also a very charismatic speaker. They said about Reb Chaim Shurim, he captivated his audiences. That was a trait that was passed down to his children and grandchildren. The Rav was well known for his incredibly captivating oratory style and presentation. But Reb Chaim says, I'll take the job as long as my Talmud, Reb Simcha Zelig, who at this point in time is 29 years old, he's not 30 yet, comes with to be the Dayan. Now, Brisk was not bereft of Talmid HaChachamim at this point in time. They had a Beis Din, they had Dayanim. Many of them considerably more senior than Reb Simcha Zelig. But Reb Chaim insisted, and they wanted Reb Chaim. So they had to take Reb Simcha Zelig. But they couldn't take Reb Simcha Zelig because there's Dayanim that are much older than him. There's judges that are much older than him, much more seasoned. So they reached out to the Netziv. Now the Netziv is another person that we could spend many, many, many lectures talking about. Suffice to say that the end of the Netziv's life was an abject tragedy. The Netziv was chased out of Volozhin. The Volozhin yeshiva was shut down by the Russian authorities. There's a number of colliding events that led to the closing of Volozhin yeshiva. It's very clear all of the histories understand that if not for the fact that the Talmidim were fighting between each other and what they say, massed on the yeshiva, they were most of the authorities of the yeshiva to the Russian authorities, the yeshiva would never have closed down. The official reason, the documented reason, was because the Russians insisted that they introduce secular studies. But Sara Riga writes in her book from her father, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Aaron Riga, who heard it from his father, Reb Simcha Zelig Riga, that there was one particular Talmud that really was the final nail in the coffin for the Volozhin yeshiva. He walked into the yeshiva on Yom Kippur, and the Netziv had seen that he had been eating on Yom Kippur morning, and the Netziv gave him a patch. And from that moment, he walked out, he informed on the Russian authorities, to the Russian authorities, and the yeshiva was closed. Now, the Netziv very desperately wanted, after the yeshiva closed, to make aliyah. That's his father had made aliyah, he desperately wanted to make aliyah. He was not allowed to. It's not like today that you can get on a plane and you can go to Eretz Yisrael with a couple of shekel and a passport. There you had to get permission in order to leave the country. They had to make sure that all your debts were paid off. And he was on the hook for all of the debts of the Volozhin Yeshiva, which had gone into significant debt at this point in time. He was on the hook for all of it. So he went to Warsaw to raise money and there he died. He never made it to Eretz Yisrael. But the piece of our story that the Netziv is very important for is that the Dayanim in Brisk said, if Reb Simcha Zelig is coming to be the Dayan, how can we let that happen? He doesn't know how to be the Dayan. He doesn't. So the Netziv, firstly, attested to the fact that Reb Simcha Zelig was certainly capable of being Dayan, because after the Volozhin Yeshiva died, the Netziv had left. He'd gone to Warsaw to raise money. Reb Simcha Zelig was the Dayan in Volozhin. He had been the Dayan in Volozhin for at least a few months after the Netziv had left. He was certainly capable of being a Chief Justice, of being the Dayan. But the Netziv recommended that he observe the other Dayanim for the first 6 months, and thereafter he takes over, which is exactly what happened, Kachava. And he became not only the Dayan of Brisk, but the world-renowned Dayan, the Posek of the Lithuanian world at the time. That was unparalleled. The world turned to him for shilas. It's worth noting that he had a very, very close relationship to his Rebbe, to Reb Chaim. Not only was there a close relationship of Talmud to Rebbe, which is really a relationship of Talmud Chaver. Talmud Chaver is the language that the Gemara uses to describe a relationship between a rabbi and his student that rises to the level of being a chavrusa. So he was a Talmud Chaver. They lived in the same house. Well, more or less in the same house. Reb Chaim lived on the bottom floor of the house. This was the house that was provided to them by the community. Reb Chaim lived on the bottom floor of the house, and Reb Simcha Zelig and his family lived on the top floor of the house. There was a staircase in between. That was how they lived all the years that Reb Simcha Zelig lived in Brisk. There's an amazing story about the loyalty that Reb Simcha Zelig had for his Rebbe, for Reb Chaim, that Reb Shechta tells. Many of the pieces that we'll discuss this evening, Reb Shechta has recorded in his numerous Svarim, both in Reb Soloveitchik and also his own Svarim. The story is, feel free to read it in Hebrew on page number 5 in the middle box, Talmid HaKofov L'Rabbi, a student that is subservient to his teacher. This is a story of Reb Soloveitchik, the Rav, as we know him. The Rav was a young child, and he came to visit. It was, I think, the story was it was a Yom Tov. He came for Yom Tov for a Shavuos. He was visiting the grandfather. He was visiting Reb Chaim in Brisk. He was a young child at this point in time, maybe 3 or 4 years old, and he was feeling very ill. So they called over a doctor. And this was on a Shabbos. They called over a doctor to take a look down young Yosheba Soloveitchik's throat. And he gets there, and it's night time. The doctor gets there and is looking down young Soloveitchik's throat. And Reb Chaim says to the doctor, "Do you need more light? Now it's Shabbos. How are you going to get more light? Do you need more light?" He says, "Yeah, not a bad idea. Not a bad idea." So Reb Chaim turns to his son, the Rav's father, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, and says to him, "Turn up the light," meaning raise the wick of the candle, raise the wick of the lamp. Now that's a malacha d'oraisa on Shabbos. You can't do that on Shabbos. Reb Chaim says to his son, "Turn up the lamp," because Reb Chaim at Paskin that this was a question of pikuach nefesh. This was a question of saving a life. So Reb Chaim says to his son, "Turn up the light." Reb Moshe looks at him and he says, "No, Tati, it's Shabbos. Maybe we shouldn't do like that." At which point in time, Reb Chaim turns to his Talmid Chaver of Simcha Zelig, and says, "You turn up the light," which Reb Simcha Zelig does with no problem. And then Reb Chaim says about his own son, and you'll see this, it's in Yiddish in the middle, "Eris an Amaretz," says about his son, Reb Moshe, "He's an ignoramus, he doesn't know the halacha." Meaning, the truth is that this is a complicated question in halacha, whether or not for a child in such a circumstance. Reb Moshe was saying, but the doctor didn't even insist, the doctor didn't say, he just said maybe it's a good idea. Reb Simcha Zelig, "If Reb Chaim said I should turn up the light, I turn up the light. If my Rebbe says I do it, I do it." He was, now that's not because Reb Simcha Zelig was not capable of rendering halachic decisions on his own. In fact, Reb Chaim regularly asked Reb Simcha Zelig's opinion. However, the Rebbe said I should do it, he should do it. Now in the Rishimus HaShiurim that they write in Reb Soloveitchik, there's a footnote. You'll see this at the bottom. This is just for, you see, this is how it works in the world of Brisk, is from the story, there's important halachic material to Ghana. What's the important halachic material to Ghana? I'll read this inside. This is good lumdus. He says, in number 187, "Pam k'sher Rabbeinu Zal haya tinek v'choyle muskav barisosei b'shabbos." So once when Soloveitchik was sick, he was visiting the grandfather, he was sick, it was the Shabbos, B'nachos HaGon Reb Chaim Zatzal, he was visiting the grandfather, "He gear roipe lebodka v'shalo agrachzal im lehalikas haner, haya oizel v'bedikas hayela l'chole," if you should light the candle, if it would be helpful, "sh'aroife omre she'achein yazolei," when the doctor said, yes, it would be helpful, "kibed Reb Chaim zal sadain debrisk harav HaGon Reb Simcha Zelig Zatzal." He told Reb Simcha Zelig to do it. What's the halachic relevance of this? So the Shulchan Aruch says that when there's a question of pikuach nefesh, who's supposed to violate Shabbos? Not by a goya, not by a katan, says the Shulchan Aruch, but by the Rav Ha'ir. But Reb Chaim didn't do this. He was the Rav Ha'ir. He told Reb Simcha Zelig to do it. So the footnote here, it says, apparently Rav Chaim was holding that b'mitzvah hatzala la'adlik hazaner v'chazin shemutar l'chabin chacham acher b'mitzvah hatzala. You're allowed to tell another chacham to do it. Doesn't davka have to be the Rav Ha'ir? The Rav Ha'ir can tell another chacham that that he should do it. Now that's important, relevant halachic material. It means that if there's reason to violate Shabbos for Achel, it doesn't have to be the rabbi. The rabbi can tell another Talmud Chacham in the shul, you go and do it for whatever reason. So this has halachic relevance, not just historical relevance. What kind of life did Rav Simcha Zelig have in Brisk? So the next few pages you'll see, and we'll zoom in a little because it's a little bit small on your page, is taken from the interviews of Sara Riga with her father. You'll see the bold text that begins with "my father." It's worth seeing the questions and answers of the direct interview at the top, but we're not going to have time for everything. She writes as follows: "My father described the house as having two large bedrooms, one tiny one, a kitchen, and a large central room that was used as a dining room study." So we're talking about like Bekoshi, a New York apartment. Lower East Side, right? He says, "The kitchen held the wood-burning stove, the cooking utensils, cutlery, basins of all sizes, and a tub for laundry and bathing. There was no indoor plumbing and no indoor toilet." Brisk today has the name of being this illustrious place of Talmud Torah. Brisk, the place, not the style of learning, not the yeshivas today. Brisk, the town, was rural. It was like a backwater village. You're not talking about, like, Warsaw was the metropolis, Moscow was the big city. Brisk was a town. Brisk was a shtetl. The Rav and the Dayan had no indoor plumbing. It's a different world. There was no indoor plumbing, no indoor toilet. The town's Jews finally paid for indoor plumbing just as the Second World War began, just before the Nazis occupied the house. Later in the book, she writes that Rav Simcha Zelig never got to enjoy the indoor plumbing because the Nazis took over the house right after it was renovated. Never got to enjoy the indoor plumbing. His whole life never had indoor plumbing. She writes, "When all of the girls lived at home, the second bedroom was occupied by them. The two older sons were long out of the house, living first in yeshivas and then on their own." We'll talk about those two older sons a little bit later. That's part of the tragedy. "But things changed as the girls grew up. Meanwhile, my grandmother had to do all of the cooking, cleaning, laundry, and childcare herself. Life was not easy." This is Sarka. Simcha Zelig's wife was in charge of all of these things. I'll read this piece now, because she writes it at this point in the story, just to illustrate the relationship between Rav Simcha Zelig and his Rebbetzin. They had a very beautiful relationship. He was very strict in many ways on himself and very lenient with the rest of the world. And we'll see this as a tendency in his life. She writes, "My grandfather's custom was not to visit cemeteries." He was a Litvak, a real Litvak. You don't, why are you going to cemeteries? "You buried the dead, you marked the yard site by studying Mishnayos, one chapter for each letter of the deceased name, matching the chapter's initial letter to the letter of the names, as is the custom of many. Even the custom of visiting cemeteries during the month of Elul, which is followed by the majority of Jews of the world, was not to my grandfather's liking." And as far as Rav Simcha Zelig was concerned, this is a real Litvisher approach. You'd rather learn Torah than visit cemeteries. Learn Torah, do mitzvahs, give tzedakah, say Mishnayos in memory of somebody, visiting the cemetery that's engaging the world of the dead. Torah is Divrei Elokim Chayim. You live in the world of life. Visiting cemeteries was not Rav Simcha Zelig's custom. "My grandmother, by contrast, went to the cemetery often." So you see this already, that the husband says, don't go, the grandmother goes. "My grandmother, by contrast, went to the cemetery often." And you'll start to get an appreciation of the tragedy of the Simcha Zelig's life. "She went to visit the graves of her dead firstborn and all of her other babies who died during childbirth or soon thereafter." Rav Simcha Zelig and Sarka had 13 children total, buried 6 of them. This is not a long time ago, Chavra. This is not a long time ago. Infant mortality, childhood mortality was was very high. The first child they lost within hours, days, weeks, we're not 100% sure. But they said that Rabbi Simcha Zalig went gray almost overnight after the death of his Bechar. My father said that my grandmother gave birth to at least 13 times, at least. She went to the cemetery to cry, and my grandfather and father understood this and understood how hard her life was. So he looked the other way instead of imposing his views on his wife. His compassion for others was part of his international reputation. For in his halachic decisions, he was a makil. Now, Brisk today is not famous for being makil. Rav Simcha Zalig, the Dayan of Brisk, was known as a makil, a decider who searched for the least onerous legal decision. It was very easy to say no and to see Judaism as black or white, but that is not the true Jewish way. It is in the gray areas that we must function. It is ironic that this was my grandfather's way, since no one knows where he is buried, and therefore no one can ever visit his grave. In effect, we are forced to observe his custom in regard to him. Nobody knows where Rav Simcha Zalig is buried. So, what was life like? Sariga asks her father, where did you get food? He answers, my father used to answer all of the shilas, all of the lungs, the gusas, the dakas, all of the animals that would come. So the butchers used to pay him in kind with meat. Not only were, the balabastas coming, but the butchers. I mean, if you shecht a cow, you don't sell a cow to one person. You sell a cow to, 15, 20. A lot of people are going to eat, a lot of families are going to eat from one cow. So they would shecht a cow, they would shecht a goat, they would shecht a sheep. So the butchers used to pay him in kind with meat because they didn't have the money to pay. He says, we always ate meat for Shabbos. So that was one of the privileges. What did you eat during the week? All kinds of things. Did your sisters work? Later, my sisters became nurses in the hospital. Father allowed them to work on Shabbos. That's Pikuach Nefesh. The nurses are allowed to work in the hospital. Did they have to get an education to be a nurse? That's a strange question to ask today. Did they have to go to school, or was this just something that you went and did? So he says they had an education. Father was not against this. They took 4 years of classes. Goldie and Esther, two of the daughters, supplemented the family's income. Your older sister was already married? Yes, when we were refugees. Now, they were refugees during the First World War. They ran away from Brisk to Minsk, and then on to Volozhin during the First World War, and that's when Reb Chaim died. And we'll talk about that period in a few minutes. So you see the interviews, the topics go from topic to topic, but I figured I'd include this because Pesach is coming. So he says, tell me about your Seder. So it's just a little bit. Father used to stop at every word, every small thing while we read the Haggadah and explained every minute detail. Once when he was explaining a section, he began to cry over the tzaris that we had in Egypt. Very much connected to the pain of the Jewish people. This is amazing. Another time when I was really small, I was fighting with my sister Peshki under the table. I hit her so much that she started crying and yelling. And so the little children having a fight under the Seder table. Then father hit me. Rav Simcha Zalig hit his son. I can never forget it, for mother begged him to stop. Stop! He can die from such slaps. Probably couldn't have died from such slaps, but this is the mother telling the father. Father was far from anxious to hit anyone. He never hit the children, especially not me. But this was too much. I was a child. What did I know? Meaning the only time that he really ever hit his children was when they were beating each other up. That was the only time. He was a very sweet, very, very gentle man. Very gentle, very mild-mannered. So you all sat and discussed, and he explained everything. This was the Seder. Yes, he had shmura matzah, but only for him. Imagine today, people have shmura matzah for the whole of Pesach. He had like one kazai, so shmura matzah. And that was he was makpid on shmura matzah for himself. He says, for you needed teeth of iron for it. But he ate it. He was strict not to eat anything else, but he allowed us to. You see, once again, every kula in the book for everybody else. But shmura matzah, this thick, in Brisk, apparently the shmura matzah was very hard and very thick. He ate shmura matzah, but everybody else ate regular matzah. He was made kill for him, for everyone except himself on everything. For example, Saturday night after Maariv, he waited 72 minutes, according to Rabbeinu Tam, before he would make Havdalah. He asked everyone else not to wait, but they waited. So he insisted, nobody should wait for me, and they all did. This was true, by the way, not just in relation to his family, but in relation to the community as well. He insisted that nobody wait for him for Shema, nobody wait for him for Shemana Esrei. He did not daven at the front of the shul. He davened in the middle of the shul, and we'll see in a few minutes, he never wore rabbinic garb. Never ever wore rabbinic garb. You'll see this over here. My grandfather refused to wear modern Western suits. He didn't want to look too modern, or hats. But he did not wear rabbinic garb. Rather, he chose to wear the long black kapata that was a long-established traditional garb for men of Eastern Europe. Of course, at one time, that had actually been a modern look. But after hundreds of years, it was traditional. That's how it goes. Let's talk about photographs for a minute. Every photograph of him that we have shows him in this black coat and wearing a brimmed cap, or once in a while, a Russian-style Cossack fur hat. He also had a winter coat lined with fur on the inside, with only the fur of the collar showing. It would have been immodest to let more of the fur be visible. Because that looks too spitz. Too spitz to have too much fur showing. The fur of the collar had to be revealed. So he wore it for warmth, not for fashion. He was not interested in fashion. We have maybe half a dozen pictures of Reb Simcha Zalig. The reason is the following. My grandfather never posed for pictures. Whatever photographs exist of him were taken at times when he was oblivious of the photographer, generally thinking over a question that was asked of him. Or in the famous image of him with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's son, Reb Velvel, that's one picture that we have. I could not find a clear enough copy to show you, but I'll show you a not so clear one. He was too polite to move out of the way. So they're taking a picture, but he didn't want to be rude. The only pictures that he posed for the ones that were taken when my father visited Brisk in 1937, the year after his marriage, and the year before my grandmother died. That's the picture that we have at the front. The front page was the one of when Reb Simcha Zalig's son visited Brisk, so he got an official picture taken. So we have a very sweet, very mild-mannered, tremendous Talmud Chacham. Somebody that cared deeply about his family, cared deeply about his community, cared deeply about his children and his wife, cared deeply about halacha. But in order to understand him in the world of halacha and the world of Reb Simcha Zalig as a posek, we have to delve both into some stories and some learning. You ready? Everybody holding on? You excited for this? There's some great stories. Amazing, amazing stories. This story is taken from Rabbi Meller's book. You'll see a certain humility and a certain boldness in the story. They don't make people like this today. I want to read this to you in the original as Rabbi Meller writes it. He says, this story was told to him from somebody that lived in Brisk at the time. Kasher lanti bebeise b'meshech tkufa mesuyemes, I was staying in Reb Simcha Zalig's house. I saw him sitting up one night, not with a sefer, with a chicken. He's darshining over a chicken. There was a question, is the chicken kosher, is the chicken treif? And he is enumerating all of the different opinions of the poskim, all of the Rishonim and Acharonim. On that topic of that particular question, Uva Limnoisan, and he is now counting them. This is the way that many poskim operate. When there is a question, you see what the majority opinion is. You have a question, you're not entirely sure, you count up this amount of poskim, say yes, and this amount of poskim say no, and you can rule with the majority. But in this particular instance, it was even. There were an even amount of recognized authorities that were lenient and an equal amount of recognized authorities that were strict. Now, ladies and gentlemen, how would you paskin in such a case? Just to fill you in, this is a question of treifus, right? If you have a question of a safek d'oraisa, a biblical law, and you're not sure what the law is, you have half of the poskim say mutter, half of the poskim say aser, this is what's called the safek d'oraisa. How would you paskin a safek d'oraisa? L'chumra. You have to be strict, right? You have to be strict. Safek d'oraisa l'chumra. You have a question in a biblical law, you have to rule l'chumra. Listen to this. This is somebody that listens to Rav Simcha Zelig paskening this question. He says, it's mechza al mechza. As milmil Rav Simcha Zelig la'atmei. Then Rav Simcha Zelig mutters to himself, listen to these words. They don't make people like this. Un ich bin euch edeya. I am also an authority. Un ich bin machshir. And I say it's kosher. It's 50-50. I think it's kosher. Meaning, my value is now added to the weight of the mekil. That's how deep Rav Simcha Zelig wanted to be mekil. Now, that's not because he decided to be mekil because he was a sweet guy. He was a sweet guy. But he really truly believed that the question was mekil. He wouldn't have ruled against the majority of people that were oser. So the complexities of one chicken. He's sitting up late at night deciding, what do I do with this chicken? Ich bin euchadeh. I also have an opinion. So Riga writes, my father told me that my grandfather memorized the entire Talmud. He memorized it to such a degree he could cross-reference anything that came up in terms of halachic questions. He knew ganshas, backwards, forwards. None of his descendants has inherited this capability, although many did inherit aspects of his analytical abilities. He was brilliant. How brilliant? So listen to this story. Rabbi Meller writes this in the book. He says, Rav Zev Edelman, who was a student and a child in Brisk at the time, tells the story that he would be sent from time to time with a question for Rav Simcha Zelig. Top line of that second box on page number 8. Shekola ema shahaya nishalach ben aras al yidei hayrav lishol shele behalacha es hagon Rav Simcha Zelig hayam mishtamit melelech. He never wanted to go ask the question. Why not? He says, shegen b'chol pam kazoi haya alav laver b'china al yidei b'mesech shayisik ba. Because any time that he went to Rav Simcha Zelig, Rav Simcha Zelig would give him a faher, would quiz him on whatever mesech that he was learning. How? He's just coming to ask a question. Listen to this. Kasher haya matzik b'fonav es ha'ashana b'halacha whenever he would go, he would say, I was asked to ask you this particular question. He would respond, what mesechta are you learning right now? He would say, whatever mesechta he was learning, he would say immediately, ah! Your question is answered by this Tosfos in the Masechta that you're learning. Which means that Rav Simcha Zelig could pull out of any Masechta, anywhere in Shas, whatever he was being asked about. Talk about somebody that was bucky, that was holding in Gan Shas Poskim backwards, forwards, inside out. There was nothing that was Nelem from him. There's a great story that they tell. The Brisker Rav's son tells the story that they were having this conversation. They were having a conversation in learning that some of the students, the Bachram, were learning with the Brisker Rav, Rav Chaim's son, who's known as Rav Elvel. And Rav Simcha Zelig walked past and got a snippet of what they're saying. Got a snippet of the conversation. And they were like asking a question. He just heard a little piece of it. And responds immediately, and you see this is three lines from the bottom of the bottom box on page number 8. He says, V'harei b'rash b'uktzin kosov loikach. Didn't the rash in uktzin deal with this? Now, for those that are not aware, uktzin is a mesechta that nobody learns. Uktzin is like the most far-flung mesechta, literally the end of Shas. The rash is not the rush. This is why I put this in the original Hebrew. The Rosh is well learned. The Rosh Rabbeinu Asher, one of the great poskim of Ashkenazi Jewry, moved after the Reifleisch massacres, moved from Germany to Spain. His son, the Tur, wrote the Arbaturim on which the Shulchan Aruch is based. The Rosh is well learned. The Rash is the Rash Mishans. It's one of the Balei Atosis that wrote a commentary on the Mishnais. Very few people learn the Rash. Now, in the translation, when Feldheim translated this, they made a mistake. So this is on the recording. They wrote the rush. And he said, isn't this a rush in Uxin? It's not a rush, it's a rush. Nobody learns the rush. The rush is like the most obscure thing to learn in the most obscure Masechta. He walks past, he hears a snippet of conversation. And he goes, it's a rush in Uxin. Which obviously meant that everybody standing around had to pick up their jaws from the floor. Just the Bekiyas, the extent of his absolute knowledge, his mastery of Talmud and Poskim, unparalleled. Three more stories. Somebody overheard the story, I don't know if it's the same Bacha that overheard that first story about Ich bin Eichadea. He's sitting up late one night figuring out a chicken. This was a common thing. And you see the sensitivities, this is what you were mentioning before. You don't need so much Yiddish for this. The bottom line of that box, he's turning the chicken over and over with the whole of Shas running through his head. And he says, Tate, Tate Zisa, Momin Yehudi, Momin Yehudi. Ribbono Shel Olam, what am I going to do? This is Jewish money. Have to find a way to be makel. Ribbono Shel Olam, how can I tell this woman that the chicken's tripe, what's she going to eat? Momin Yehudi. Now, if you're wondering, after all of this, what the relationship was between Reb Chaim, the Rav of the city, and Reb Simcha Zelig. So, on they put up a memorial website of Reb Moshe Twersky, Hashem Yom Kamta Mazeche Tzalik V'Chorosh Levracha, of Divrei Torah and stories that he told. So he tells the story that was heard from Reb Tzenatara Twersky, that Reb Chaim so valued his relationship with Reb Simcha Zelig, that Rabbi Tzenatara Twersky says that one time when Reb Chaim received a letter from his son Reb Moshe, he put on his coat and started to make his way out the house. Now that he had to go out the house to go up the stairs to get to Reb Simcha Zelig's apartment. And his daughter asked him, Tati, where are you going? And Reb Chaim answered, Moshe sent me Berela's Torah. Who's Berela? Reb Soloveitchik, right? Right? I mean, Reb Soloveitchik was writing to his father who was in Brisk. He was writing to his father. His father writes these Torahs over to Reb Chaim, who says, oh, Moshe's sharing with me Berela's Torahs. I have to go and show it to Reb Simcha Zelig. That was the relationship. It was such a respect, such a chavashaft. But it wasn't just Reb Chaim that valued Reb Simcha Zelig's opinion. This is a very famous picture. Anybody know who this picture is? You got to know this picture. Who's this picture? On the left-hand side is Reb Shimon Shkop, and on the right-hand side is the Gadol Harabanim of the generation, Reb Chaim Oyser. Reb Chaim Oyser, if you didn't get smicha from Reb Chaim Oyser, you couldn't be a Rav. That was how it worked. Meaning once you had gone through the system, you got smicha from whoever you got smicha from, you then went to Reb Chaim Oyser, he gave you a fahera and he gave you smicha. If you didn't have smicha from Reb Chaim Oyser, you didn't get a job. That was it. Reb Chaim Oyser was the authority. So we have a few of these letters about a particular Shaila in a get. The a get that was possible or potentially possible that went back between Reb Chaim Oyser, and Reb Simcha Zelig. It was considerably younger than Reb Chaim Oyser. And Reb Simcha Zelig found a way to be Mekel, and Reb Chaim Oyser wanted to be Machmir, that this woman could not remarry. She was an Aguna, she could not remarry. Couldn't find a way to be lenient. And Reb Simcha Zelig wrote backwards and forwards in his letters that are exchanged, until finally Reb Chaim Oyser agreed with Reb Simcha Zelig. He agreed that Reb Simcha Zelig was correct. What was his response to be proven wrong by Reb Simcha Zelig? Listen to the praise that Reb Chaim Oyser has for Reb Simcha Zelig. He says as follows. Says Reb Chaim Oyser, I says, he says, me in the last decades, I've dedicated my life to the Jewish people. Va'isi torid b'hem v'in yonim achirim l'mal rush. He says, and I've been engaged with the community and other issues. I've been swimming. It's gone above my head. What about Reb Simcha Zelig? Ach Reb Simcha Zelig l'umas zois hayachacham. He says, Reb Simcha Zelig was much smarter than me. Hu zocha l'shamesh es Reb Chaim kol yomav. He sat by Reb Chaim's feet his whole life. Milei kresei betur shulchan aruch. He filled up his belly with the tur with the shulchan aruch. Uchuvas harishonim. And the halachic literature of the Rishonim, va'asag rak b'hora kol yomav, his entire life he paskin shilas. Muvan me'ilav, it is understandable, shehu zacha lios nachis le'umka dedina. It makes sense that he managed to achieve a more correct understanding, a deeper understanding of the halacha, and to be able to paskin according to the truth. Va'onres advarim ha'elu, zalgo enov, he began to cry that Reb Simcha Zelig was such a Talmud Chacham. That was the respect that the entire Jewish world had for Reb Simcha Zelig. So much so that there's stories upon stories that when the Chafetz Chaim was sick, he asked for a bracha from Reb Simcha Zelig. It's astounding. The world came to Reb Simcha Zelig's feet. They wrote to him, they visited him. Reb Simcha Zelig was the Gadol HaPoskim. After the First World War, they moved back to Brisk. They had fled, they had gone to Minsk, and then they had gone to Volozhin. The war ends, and they came back to Brisk. So Riga asked her father, when you move back to Brisk, you move back to the same house? Yes, we were refugees in Bobrisk. Rabbi Shapiro's son ran up to father in the street and blurted out that Reb Chaim had died. That was how he received word that his best friend and Rebbe had passed away. Somebody ran up to him and said, oh, Reb Chaim died. Father almost fainted. He had no sense. He should have at least waited to tell him in the house and spoken carefully. A month later, the Poles took Bobrisk and Brisk. 10 men came as a delegation from the community and brought a tzav rabbonis to father, telling him that he should be the Rav of Brisk. Mother was so happy. Here, the Rebbetzin was like, oh, finally my husband is going to be the Rav of Brisk. Right? He's been the number two. He's been the assistant rabbi. He's been the dayan. He wasn't really an assistant rabbi. It was a different position. He was paskening all of the shilas. The whole world was coming to him. But now he's going to have the most mechubadik position. But father said that Reb Chaim had given him a hint that Reb Velvel, Reb Chaim's younger son, should be the Rav, so he could not accept it. He refused. My Rebbe had hinted to me that he wanted his son to take his place. He never accepted the position. But the community did not want Reb Velvel because he was hard to deal with. Why? He was a big machmir. He followed the stringencies of Jewish law. He was a big machmir. The community was very, very nervous that Reb Velvel, who later became known as the Brisker Rav, should be the Brisker Rav. They wanted Reb Simcha Zelig. Why? Because he was the Mekel. He, Tate, Momen Yisrael, Tate Zisa, what are you going to do about Momen Yehudi? Reb Simcha Zelig had to be Isaac. We'll talk about the Brisker Rav in a second. Just Reb Simcha Zelig had to be Isaac in many, many things, and we're going to see two of these tshuvas in a few minutes. In order to deal with issues that were of the modern period, especially with connected to new technologies, my grandfather had to master an understanding of these new technological advances. One of his most famous responses deals with the question of whether or not it's permissible to use a refrigerator on Shabbos. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. He had to understand not only the workings of electricity, but also the principles behind what caused a machine to automatically turn itself on by his thermostat. He interviewed engineers and asked them pertinent questions. He then applied principles of Talmudic law to what he had learned and ruled that refrigerators could indeed be used on Shabbos, and we'll talk about that in a few moments, thereby laying the groundwork for all later halachic decisions connected with thermostats, electricity, and modern technology in general, and we're going to discuss this in a few minutes. But before we get on to some of the pertinent halachic decisions, there's a story that Rav Shechter has in Mipnei Harav about Reb Simcha Zelig's continued functioning as the Poisek of Brisk, even after Reb Chaim had passed away and Reb Velvel, the Brisker Rav, had taken over. We're not going to read the story in great detail, but the preamble to the story was Reb Chaim Oizer writes in one of his tshuvas that I asked this question to the Brisker Rav and the Brisker Rav agreed with me. That was just a piece of a tshuva. I asked this question to Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, the son of Rav Chaim, and he agreed with me. And Rav Shechta says, I couldn't believe that Rav Velvel paskened the question. Rav Velvel never paskened shailas, never ever paskened a shaila. How could it be that Rav Velvel paskened a question? So it came out that Rav Velvel never paskened this question. Rav Chaim Oyster asked him what he thought, and Rav Velvel did nothing. He didn't nod, he didn't shake, and he didn't say anything. Rav Chaim Oyster said, he probably agrees with me. That's how Rav Shechta had heard about that particular tshuva. But to prove the point that Rav Velvel never ever paskened, they tell a story, and this is related to the previous thing that we spoke about Pikuch Nefesh on Shabbos, is that once on a Shabbos ran into the Beis Medrash, a person screaming that somebody was injured. Now the person that was injured was not a frum Jew, was a communist, but he was a Yid, and he needed treatment. Now, who's going to run out and paskin all the shalas of what they can do for this person? The Rav Ha'ir. Right? That's the person that has to deal with what's going on. So this is in the middle of davening. It was a Shabbos and a Yontif. It was Shavuos morning. This is the story about the Shavuos morning. And Rav Velvel runs out and it's in the middle of Shachris. So the community is all waiting for him to return. So they schlepped out the laning. Because they didn't want him to have to miss Musaf with the minion. So they schlepped out the whole laning. Finally, he gets back just as they're starting Musaf, and he runs to his place in the front of the shul, and he davens Musaf. Bless you. But as he's davening Musaf, he's like very tumultic because he's just dealt with a massive life-saving situation. He's tumultic. He gets to the end of davening, and he doesn't remember which Mana Esra he davened. This happens even to Big Gedolim. It happened to the Brisker Rav after dealing with like a crazy story of saving somebody's life. Now, what's the halacha if you don't remember what you said in davening? So there's Simonim and Shulchan Aruch. They talk about these things. These are not the hardest questions in the world to answer. And the Brisker Rav knew Shulchan Aruch backwards, forwards, inside out, could certainly paskin halacha for himself. However, this question of a yalla v'yava question on Yantif, right? Which every community rabbi needs to be able to answer, right? I'm sure Rabbi Goldberg gets this question at least a few times a year. I don't remember what I said, what I didn't say. You have to be able to answer these questions. Rav Velvel for sure had gotten such questions before, but Rav Simcha Zelig was in the shul. So the Rav of the shul goes to ask the Dayan, goes to ask Rav Simcha Zelig, because you can't pass him. Rav Simcha Zelig is the Dayan. So Rav Velvel goes and he asks Rav Simcha Zelig. Rav Simcha Zelig tells him what to do. So it was on this story that Rav Shechta had been astounded that Rav Simcha Zelig would have paskened anything to agree or to disagree with Rav Chaim Oyster. Rav Velvel never paskened anything. Rav Simcha Zelig was the Dayan. That was it. That was it. Now, just in terms of interesting coolers that arose, one of the more interesting discussions that I've gotten this question a number of times is, can you make ice on Shabbos? Can you make ice on Shabbos? So this is a fascinating question, right? Can you make ice on Shabbos? This is a particularly fascinating question because it is a super modern question. Shabbos is very old and ice is very old, but freezers are very recent, historically in the Jewish people. Nobody ever had a shaila of making ice on Shabbos. Where did ice come from? Either it was on the ground or it didn't exist. Right? You didn't make ice. God made ice. Right? Now human beings can make ice. They can cool things to the point that they can freeze water on Shabbos. So the question was raised. Can you make ice on Shabbos? So we have a letter that Rav Simcha Zelig sent to Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. That's the Rav's father, Rav Chaim's son, who's Rav Velvel's brother. Right? That's just, we have the whole family tree. While Rav Moshe was in New York, he was already, teaching in YU at the time. That Rav Moshe Feinstein had ruled that it was Osir. Rav Simcha Zelig says, it's mutter. He found a way to be makel. Rav Simcha Zelig paskened that it was mutter to make ice on Shabbos. How's he such a big makel? So two little vignettes that you have to know on page number 11. Mesuparki Rabbah Rav Chaim Bikesha Say in Boil Hashamish Kapaisik, when he was hired to be the Paisik, Rav Chaim says to him, Ana mikem vakesh ani, please, I request of you, ki loisiv so ki im al pi din v'loy lechumris. He says, I require that you paskin the halacha with no chumris. You paskin the halacha. So he was always very makel. When he was also, how come you always makel? The din is always makel. Rav Simcha Zelig responded, "Ma'asa, what can I do? Yedei anisha zemutar. I know that it's mutar. If I know that it's mutar, the din is the din. Rav Chaim told me I have to tell you the din, and if I know that it's mutar, it's mutar." But he worked very hard to make sure that as many shilas as possible were mutar. Now, while he was the dayan in Brisk, He was also a Rosh Yeshiva of a small base medrash. The base medrash was called Mishmar. It was also called Taras Chesed. He was one of the two Rosh Yeshiva of this little yeshiva. And one of the Talmidim writes about him. You'll see this on page number 11, the bottom box. It's just beautiful to see from a Talmid. We don't have many recorded things from Talmidim. Many people asked him shailas, but they were not his Talmidim. This is what one Talmid writes of him, the second line over here. Rav Simcha Zelig haya dal virazeh. He was skinny, he was thin. Gal shel atzamas mamish. He was like a bag of bones. He was a very skinny guy. Ach hashchina hayis lo shruya al panav. But the shchina, Hashem's presence, was resting on his face. Noisav legdulasoy b'torah haya bal midas Trumios, aside from being an immense Talmud Chacham, he was also a huge Balmidus. Anov v'shafel berach. He was incredibly modest, incredibly humble. Pashtan b'limudav, explained things simply when learning v'shiuroi. Loi hayo omid pilpulim. He didn't do any fancy footwork when he was teaching. Shiuroi asa roshim ki'ilu hu omer daf gemara poshut. When he would teach, it came out like he was just saying over the Pasha of the Gemara questions that people had. You know, when you learn a Daf Gemara, you can have 1,000 questions. When he gave Shir, it felt like this was just what the Gemara had said. He explained everything so beautifully, so simply. Va'aliba de'emes, according to the truth. Chadar Rav Simcha Zelig le'umka shel ha'sugya, he penetrated the depths of the sugya. Vayim etarits v'pashtas kol kushas Rabbi Kiva Eger v'yeser ha'mefarshim. He explained away all of the questions that Rabbi Kiva Eger and everybody else had asked. V'hoir le'talmidim derech havana pshuta b'talmud. He taught people to look at the Talmud and to understand it simply. Not superficially, but to understand it with clarity. Derech havana pshuta b'talmud b'shitas Rav Chaim. In the way of teaching of Rav Chaim. Now, those two things today are irreconcilable, right? Rav Chaim's derech is well known for being complex. Rav Simcha Zelig would teach the opinions and the way of learning of Rav Chaim, but it would come across as beautifully simple. He had such a command of Talmud, such a command of all of Halacha, that he would teach all the complexities and everybody understood them. He was well known to have been one of the best of Velazhen. He was known as the right hand of Rav Chaim in all questions. He was also well known as a tzaddik. People came to him for brachas. He was not just a gun, he was a tzaddik as well. And Rav Chaim would send people to Rav Simcha Zelig so that Rav Simcha Zelig should daven for them. Panav alizos tamid, he was always happy. Big smile on his face. He was a person of incredible graciousness and mercy. Ma'olam loye ra'u kais, he never got angry. Kol chayav hayuchaye oni v'dachkos. And his whole life was miserable and poor. Smile on his face, bag of bones, gun and a tzaddik. One of his other students writes about him on page number 12. Afal pi shirev chach me'adar hayupanim la'gon Rav Simcha Zelig be'shelo som. Even though the entirety of the Jewish world turned to Rav Simcha Zelig with their questions, v'chol b'nei iroi chalkaloi kovod, and everybody in his town wanted to honor him, ma'olim lo hiniach l'shum adol mashamshay. He never had a shamish. He never had anybody that assisted him. He did everything himself. Lo chavash mitznefet shel rav. He never wore rabbinic clothes. Lo yashov liyad arin kodesh k'minig shel rabbanim. He never sat by the mizrach. Lo hitrich et zatzir lahamtin. Lo, he never told anybody to wait for him. Ela hikpid liyos ke'echad am. He wanted to be a poshut yid. like one of the people. Bechedroi loy haya daltos. His office and his house never had doors. Never had doors. Ke'en samul shebeis ha-pasuach haya l'kol. So that people should know that his house was available to everybody. And the entire world came to him to speak to him in learning, came to him to speak to him in life. Now I should point out that that house that Rav Simcha Zelig and Rav Chaim Brisker had, the doors were never, ever, ever closed. Never, ever closed to that house. So much so that they once asked Rav Chaim, why do you have doors? It's a good question, right? If the doors are never locked, the doors are never closed, so why do you have doors? Says Rav Chaim, because according to the Rambam, you're not chayv in mezuzah d'oraisa if you don't have a door. So I have to have a door in order to be able to be mekayim the mitzvah according to the Rambam. It's the only reason that there were doors on that double story house. That was the world that they lived in. That was the world that they lived in. There are many, many stories of Reb Simcha Zelig and Reb Chaim sitting and learning, and there'd be a knock on the window and a bundle would be thrown in. And the bundle would be a baby that some Jewish girl had that didn't want to have necessarily, or that didn't have the money to raise, and was now Reb Chaim's problem. It was now Reb Chaim's problem. Many stories are Reb Simcha Zelig helping Reb Chaim to find the right placement and money and food to be able to deal with these things. We're talking about Ga'one Olam, people of immense caliber, but who spent their lives taking care of Yidden. Now, Reb Chaim, by the way, in Brisk was not known as Reb Chaim like he is today. The Gadol in Brisk was Reb Simcha Zelig. That's who they came to for questions. Reb Chaim, as he's known in the yeshivas today, is from his writings. In Brisk, Reb Chaim was known as Rav Chesed. That's what it says on his kever. In fact, that's what the only thing that he allowed to be written on his kever. And then when they renovated, they wrote a Megillah. But so it says on his kever, originally it says Rav Chesed, that's what he did. He took care of people. Reb Simcha Zelig dealt with all the ritual matters. One of my colleagues in Rabbanus says to me that there's really two aspects of the rabbinate. There's the marketing of Judaism and the management of Judaism, right? So Reb Chaim dealt with marketing. He dealt with the drushes and he dealt with the tzibur and he dealt with the public relations. Reb Simcha Zelig dealt with the management. All the questions of kashrus and the questions of Shabbos and the questions of halacha. He was the posek. That's how they divided the responsibilities in the city. Nevertheless, and you see this in the next box, I'm not going to go through it. Reb Chaim quotes Reb Simcha Zelig about a dozen times in his sefer, Reb Chaim al Rambam. Reb Simcha Zelig is throughout the sefer is quoted. And one of the great tragedies of Reb Simcha Zelig's life, as we will see shortly, is that Reb Simcha Zelig never published anything. We have no original recorded writings of Reb Simcha Zelig. We have letters that he sent, and we have that which he's quoted in other svarim. And some of the things that he wrote, bits and pieces, but he never published. The story at the bottom of page number 12 is on is also from Rav Moshe Tversky, Hashem Yikom Damo's website that was put up, Le'ilu Nishmasei. The last time that Rav Soloveitchik saw Reb Chaim in Warsaw, meaning the Rav saw his grandfather, at which point the Rav was 15, somebody asked this question to Reb Chaim, who's greater, the Ur Sameach, that's Reb Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, or Reb Simcha Zelig? And Reb Chaim said, unequivocally, Reb Simcha Zelig was greater than the Ur Sameach. You have to understand, the Ur Sameach was like, everybody held of the Ur Sameach. Why was Reb Simcha Zelig greater? Said Reb Chaim, if Mashiach would come, and they would have questions to ask, not just about treifas, not just about chickens and kosher and treif, but they would ask questions about what the Kohanim and Levim should be doing in the Beit HaMikdash, Reb Simcha Zelig would be able to answer those questions with the same surety and with the same expertise. He says, that the Ur Sameach could not do. Two very famous questions. Part of the collections of recorded writings that we have. We're not going to see it in great detail. But one is the only time basically the only time the Rishim Chazalik was machmer on a question, and that was the question of the international dateline for Jews in Japan. Rishim Chazalik paskened that on questions of de'oraisa, questions of biblical matters, meaning keeping Shabbos, for example, they should observe 2 days of Shabbos in Japan because the machlok is about the international dateline. And we're not going to go into the lumdus of this. This is, one could spend 3 or 4 hours just talking about that particular question. But on that question, he was machmir. He was famously machmir about the question about Japan, and you'll see that on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side was his question about opening refrigerators on Shabbos. What was the question about opening a refrigerator on Shabbos? Anybody here remember what happened every time you opened the refrigerator? The motor would go on, right? The motor would go on. That was the original question about refrigerators. Now that's a question of what's called psikresha, right? You know that the motor is going to go on. So you have to have a very deep understanding about motors and about Shabbos and about electricity and about refrigerators in order to pass on such a shayla. And Rav Simcha Zelig was famously makil on this question. I should point out that in the last couple of years, there was a big tumult about from a bunch of different rabbanim, it's published online, whether Rav Simcha Zelig was referring to the light that he said you could open it even though the light will go on, or even though the motor will go on. It seems posher from this tshuva that he is talking not about the light, but about the motor. And he writes, his language is lehadlik es ha-electriki, right? To turn on the electricity, which is not the light, otherwise he would have said the or, right? He's talking about the motor, which went on every time you opened it. There were the minag. I don't know if what the minag was in some of your families growing up, but I think the minag in America was you had to wait until the motor went on by itself and then you could open. This was a well-known minag. People would wait by the fridge on Shabbos lunch, waiting to take things out of the fridge. And people would wait until the motor went on. Once the motor was on, then you could open. Said Rasul Chazalik, no, you don't have to wait for that. This is based on a machlokes in the way to understand something between a tosis and a oruch. It's a big arichas. You see this on the left-hand side of page 13. We're not going to go into tremendous detail. The picture that I told you about of Rasul Chazalik walking with the Brisker Rav, you'll see on page number 14. This was published in the Yated Neman, for the 50th year anniversary of his Yahrzeit. And there's 2 pages of this. There's a bunch of stories that are recorded. This was published in the Yated. We'll tell the second story, which was on page 15, just to illustrate what kind of character this is. There's a bacher that was walking with Rav Simcha Zelig and sees a Jew coming up to them, a young man, and comes up to them and asks Rav Simcha Zelig, the Dayan, asking them a very strange question. He says, Rebbe, will I merit to marry a Jewish girl? That's what he asks him. Rav Simcha Zelig responds to him very sweetly, of course you will, of course you will. You'll marry a wonderful Ashena Meidel, right? You'll marry a wonderful Jewish girl. Fine. The guy walks away. 3 minutes later, he comes back, asks the same question again. Rebbe, will I get to marry a Jewish girl? Rav Simcha Zelig, the same sweetness, the same kindness. Of course, you'll marry a wonderful Shana Medal, you marry a beautiful Jewish girl. This happens 15 times. This bacha keeps on coming back and coming back and coming back and coming back. And every single time Rav Simcha Zelig responds to him with the same patience, the same sweetness. They find out that this bacha, obviously, had psychological issues or learning challenges, and had been bothering Rav Simcha Zelig with this question, not just that day, but for 2 weeks, every single day. And Rav Simcha Zelig responded with the same patience and the same sweetness over and over again. They asked Rav Simcha Zelig, how could you do that? How do you have the patience for it? What's his response? You see this on the last line of that box that I've outlined on page 15. We don't have the time to read the whole story. He says, "Halozai Gemara Mufreshes." Doesn't the Gemara say, "La'olam yehi adam rach kekane"? A person has to be easygoing. The Gemara says you have to be easygoing. So I'm easygoing. That's it. Staten poiskim, right? The Gemara says you have to be easygoing. So I'm easygoing. I don't understand the question. The Gemara says so, that's who I have to be. Oh, Rabbi Say, we come to the end. We come to the end. We have 15 letters that Sarah Riga found of her father's correspondence with her grandfather that she's translated. All of them are fascinating. The last letter, which is everybody scribbling a quick message, etc., was taken through Russia after the war broke out, September of 1939. The date of the arrival of this letter in America is December 1939. There is only one line from the grandfather. This is from Simcha Zelig. We are all well. Peshke and her husband Aaron are well in Brisk. That's all that he writes. We're all well. The war's broken out, but we're all well. Esther, that's sister, wrote the majority of the letter. Listen to this. To Chaim, Shimon, Goldi, Moshe Aaron, and Zalman. These are all of Rav Simcha Zelig's children that are in the United States. We are all alive, thank God. Writing about all that we have lived through is impossible. It would take the long summer days and the long winter nights to tell all the miracles that have happened to us. This is as the war has broken out. Your father was in the greatest danger. It was a miracle that he survived. The Russians cut off his long, beautiful beard. Zalman's business was sold. Zalman had gone to the United States to attend the World Fair in 1939. He was planning on bringing his family. He never saw them again. Most important, our daughters and I are still alive, and so is everyone else. It's hard, but we are all alive. My only hope is that our daughters get through this. May Hashem help us survive. Long love from the children, our wonderful gifts. And then Moshe Reuven says to Zalman, Esther sold the business, has a document attesting to it. I don't know what the business was. On September 1st, 1939, 1 week after the signing of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, Poland was invaded by Germany. On September 17th, the Russians invaded from the east, and on October 6th, 1939, Germany and the Soviet Union divided and annexed all of Poland. The Soviet Union incorporated its Polish provinces into Belarus and Ukrainian republics and began to Sovietize the areas. But before that, on September 22nd, the Soviets and the Nazis met in Brisk for a joint victory parade. It is probably during this early occupation of Brisk that my grandfather had the demeaning experience described where the Russians cut off his beard. The Soviets probably decided that they could humiliate all of the Jews by humiliating their leading rabbi. My grandfather was already in his 70s with a long, white, flowing beard. The Russians held him and cut it off. Now, this is historically significant. Menachem Begin was there in Brisk and witnessed this. And in Menachem Begin's autobiography, he tells the story. As he attested when he met my father years later in Yerushalayim, Begin came from Brisk and his father was killed there in 1941. As the Nazi occupation of Brisk begins, it was published in one of the newspapers at the time that Rav Simcha Zelig, and you'll see this in Hebrew, we're not going to go through it in all of its details, but Rav Simcha Zelig in the ghetto in Brisk, aside from being the same beautiful, sweet presence, also opened a soup kitchen and whatever bakery he could. And he made matzahs, Erev Pesach, and he held services. He had a shtibel for Shabbos and Yom Tov. And the entire world, as they turned to him before, turned to him now. But on June 22nd, 1941, Hitler broke the pact with the Soviets and attacked eastward in the beginning of Operation Barbarossa. After the initial execution of thousands of Jews in Brisk, the Nazis built the ghetto there, which was completed on December 16th. There were waves of executions over the next few months, and the beginning of the end of the ghetto was October 1942. My grandfather and all the males of the community were shot into the execution pits on the 4th of Mar Cheshvan. The women were executed the following day. People who survived, mainly by pretending to fall dead, later sent my father attestations as to what they had witnessed. Now, in the article in the Ated from the 50th Yahrzeit, they tell a story that Rav Simcha Zelig went to his death wearing his talis and tefillin. We know from later stories that that's not true. He did not go wearing his talis and tefillin, and there was halachic rationale for that. And you'll see this on the second paragraph, and I want to read this inside from Shimon Mela's book. The bottom paragraph on page 17 on the right-hand side. He says, Yachad b'nei mishpachto, huval misham agor nesim chazelig leburnia guria, he was taken to the killing pits. Kasher hi tziulai b'nei mishpachto sheyilbash kittel v'talis b'darke lebeis ha'ariga. His children, his family said to him he should wear his kittel and his talis because he is going to his death. He knew that he was going to die al kiddush Hashem. Sirev, he refused. His bir al pidina mevara b'poskim, and he had halachic rationale why he should not wear his kittel and talis. Why? He says the din is the gabe harugim al kiddushas Hashem sheish lekovram bebigdehem. The halacha is that if somebody dies al kiddush Hashem, you bury them in their clothing, the clothes that they were murdered in. Why? So that they should create a stir in Shemayim, so that Hashem should be angered as to the death of Jews. So they're buried in the clothing that they were killed in, because those clothing that they wear also have kedusha. By the way, this was Rav Soloveitchik's rationale for the kedusha of the Israeli flag. He said the Israeli flag, while it might not have inherent kedusha by its design or by its creation, how many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands have died for the Israeli flag? It has the kedusha of dying al kiddush Hashem. Says Rav Simcha Zelig, "Av hu roitze b'shas kosha zoi lelech kefi shehu bebegadav." He also wants to go in the clothes that he is wearing, the clothes that he wore his whole life. The regular Jews of the regular clothes of a traditional Jew, so that he should awaken the mercy of heaven al kol she'erish Yisrael for the rest of the Jewish people, hanasurim b'tzara v'shivya, that are in so much pain and so much distress. Even in his last moments, he is paskening a halacha for himself in a way that should be merciful to Jews. That's his life. That's his legacy. Now there's a tragedy that we have to talk about. One is that his children that were in the United States raised money and tried to get him a visa, and he refused to leave. As we've seen time and time and time again, Jews that refuse to leave. You'll see on page 18, page 19, stories that Sarah Riga records from her father about the minhagim of the home. So much of what we've discussed, take it home, enjoy. But there's a tragedy that we have to relate to, and that's not just in the death of Rav Simcha Zelig, and it's not just in that him and his wife had at least 13 children, six of whom at least they buried in their own lifetime. It's that of his sons, only one of them was Shomer Torah Umitzis. The other two became communists, as did a few of his daughters. I haven't been able to clarify. If somebody knows, please share with me. I don't know if any of Rav Simcha Zelig's descendants today are from. The Dayan of Brisk. He has a religious daughter? No, Sarig is his granddaughter. She's a professor in CUNY. She's, to what I understand, she's Shomer Torah Mitzvahs. I think she's the only one with a last name Riga that is. He had no Talmidim that survived, and no Svarim that survived. What you have at the bottom of page 19 is eight pages that's printed at the back of the Gilyum Arashar of Shlomo Ega, that his son, Harav Dr. Moshe Aaron Riga, collected. It's like 14 different pieces in other Svarim. And for the last few months, we've been talking about the world that was. And this is our final lecture. So Hadron Alach, the world that was. And I think we've all tried, myself, Rabbi Goldberg, Rabbi Moskowitz, and Rabbi Kasorla, we've all tried to show the enduring legacy, the undying legacy of those gedolim, those poskim that we lost, those the rebbes and the tzaddikim and the chassidim and the talmidei chachamim. But there's a reality that we have to understand, that the world was lost. It was mamish lost. The great Dayan of Brisk, Rav Simcha Zelig, for whom the entire world came to, who was a tzaddik yisoid olam, and from everything that we understand, an amazing father and an amazing husband, had a miserable, painful life that ended al kiddush Hashem. Afal pichein, he was a tzaddik and had a smile on his face. But not only was he lost, and not only was his world lost, but we have lost that world. And it was lost already in his lifetime, as he saw his own children leaving Torah Mitzvahs. His own children abandoning the way of Torah. If there is a legacy that I think we need to continue, of Rav Simcha Zelig, it's a passion for Torah, tenacity to withstand everything in order to do what we can to fight the waves of anti-Semitism and assimilation from within and without that we are combating today. That Rav Simcha Zelig and his legacy should be a melitz yosher for our community. They are learning. We are learning le'ilui nishmasa and le'ilui nishmas, all of those big ga'onim and tzaddikim and the 6 million. Because this life was one life out of 6 million that indeed was a world that was lost. And I mentioned at the beginning that unfortunately we're ending on a sad note. And the sad note is that the world that was lost was indeed a world that was. Be'ezus Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give us the strength to do that which we can to rebuild that world, to continue these legacies, that Be'ezus Hashem, us and our children, our children's children, should continue these illustrious legacies, and we should see such personalities like Rav Simcha Zelig arising once again in Klal Yisrael. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful evening.